Welcome back to episode 2 of Tasting Wild, Upping Your Upland Game. Today we're going to discuss a couple topics about the do's and don'ts of hunting upland game. We'll be covering a couple different animals such as dove, quail, rabbit, squirrel, pheasant, and grouse. We'll get excited on some tips and tricks, how to field dress, taboos, all that good stuff, as well as 5 amazing recipes. Those 5 amazing recipes, again, are going to be from our 5 amazing chefs. We've got Randy King here. Say hi, Randy.
How's it going, y'all?
We've got Joel.
Yay, yay!
Joel kind of has a little cold, so if he sounds like he's got boogers in his nose, he probably does.
I do it for my people. Sick, I will be here.
Next, we got the Bearded Wonder, John.
How's it going, y'all?
And next, for the first time on Tasting Wild, we've got Justin from Harvesting Nature.
Hey, how's it going, everyone?
They can't answer back, but they say that you're doing good. And I've also got myself, Jeremiah, from Field to Plate. So let's get right into this. Some upland game do's and don'ts. Now, we talk about upland game. Upland game is the number one hunting in the United States of America. It's the most popular. It's the one that most of us start out doing at a young age. I know that I started out at a very young age doing upland game. I know that my daughter, her first hunt and her second hunt is upland game, doing dove and rabbit. I see pictures of John all the time taking his boys out, upland game. So upland game is all about getting out and just being with your family and the kids because it's simple. You can walk. You can sit. You can talk and be as loud as you want and not going to really scare away the game. All right, so today we'll be discussing a couple different upland game as well as small game. Upland game, dove, quail, pheasant. We've got our small game like our rabbit and squirrel. So let's go ahead and get right into this and start talking about some tips and tricks. So John is really big into and works with quail forever. So, John, what are some do's and don'ts that you guys teach in your seminars and banquets and all that stuff when it comes to hunting small birds in the upland game category?
Sure. Well, I'd say it applies to any sort of hunting, and that's safety. You know, you always want to be safe. You know, get your certification, keep your guns pointed in a safe direction. And then secondly, it's having fun. But it's mainly a lot of etiquette, kind of like baseball, a lot of unwritten rules. You know, shoot birds in your zone. There's some do's and don'ts with quail. If you bust a covey and you have a covey rise in front of you and you shoot the first bird and you miss, and now it's further away but you've got a closer bird, you're not supposed to switch back and forth between the birds. Stick with the same bird, stick with it, and you have a better chance of dropping it. So I learned that as a new upland hunter myself, a new wing shooter. But other than that, it's just like pheasant hunting or any other wing shooting. You know, shoot your zones. Don't shoot a bird in front of someone else. Let them have the opportunity. And don't shoot at birds too far away. You know, make sure it's a good short shot. And if it's not the best shot for you, maybe it'll come down the line and be a good shot for one of your buddies.
So let's talk about zones for a second, because I know a lot of people, you are probably thinking, what is a zone? A lot of these deer hunters out there who I'm talking to that have never hunted quail, have never hunted pheasant.
That'd be me for one right here. So this is it's interesting facts.
So what is your zone? If you hunt pheasant, you usually hunt in a group. There's usually a couple guys. Quail, same. John, do you agree?
Yep.
A group of guys go out there. So imagine your zone as a V.
45 degree angles.
Right. So you've got this... You've got this V in front of you. Your cone, your scope of view. So it's saying if you're looking forward, you're within your peripherals, that's your zone. So if you've got a guy next to you and a bird pops up on his, but it's between your two zones, it becomes an unsafe shot because you're going to cross over into him and he's going to cross over into you.
It's always better to not take the shot because once it's been taken, you can't take it back. And there'll be more birds. You know, there's going to be more birds in the field and it's about having a good time. So, you know, just be courteous. You know, good sportsmanship applies to not only on the basketball court, but in the fields as well.
Guys, a question real quick. With that.
No, you can't ask a question.
Well, you know what? It's coming anyways. So with these zones, like, do you guys ever run into, like, argumentative, like, situations where, you know, a bird pops up and someone's going, well, I thought you were going to shoot it, or, you know, like, I know that you just spoke of if it comes to in between, but really, where's the fine line of that? Because if I ever go quail hunting, I don't want to look like an ass when I do it.
So being new to pheasant hunting, I had an opportunity to shoot a rooster 20 yards, jumped up straight in front of me, and I didn't pull the trigger. just in the sense that I wanted, you know, someone else to pull the trigger. And they all didn't raise their gun because it was my bird to shoot. And when I didn't, and by the time they realized it, it was too far away for anyone to get it. I caught some, some flack from my friends in a good humored nature. And I now know, you know, but you definitely want to make sure you identify it if you're shooting pheasants as a rooster. But no, they'll razz you for it a little bit, but, live and learn and, you know, be more aggressive and you can always ask for it later. It's only when it comes back with a band on it, that's when the arguments begin.
So, yeah, I agree. I love band hunting. Well, speaking of like some tips and tricks, in California, I do youth hunts with pheasant, where we go out and we actually teach new hunters who just got their hunter safety. We teach them how to hunt with a dog, how to hunt in a group, and how to hunt safely. And that becomes the biggest thing is our thing that we teach them is the closest person to the dog in the beginning is the first shot. And then we go down the line from there. So even if you're in the middle of the pack, we usually try to hunt with four kids to teach them the etiquette of hunting together in a group. Then it's myself and then a dog handler and a dog. And I'm there to teach the kids proper etiquette on how to hold the gun, where to shoot, how to aim, how to hold their head. And our biggest thing we teach them is the same thing, is if you're uncomfortable with the shot, we're all uncomfortable with the shot. If you don't feel it safe, it's not safe. But if we tell you it's a safe shot because you're nervous about it, then it's a safe shot. And a lot of new hunters that I had a chance to take out some new hunters who are 40 years old, and I told them the same thing. If you're uncomfortable taking the shot, don't take the shot.
This is great discipline. I didn't grow up a bird hunter. I grew up a deer hunter. My whole life, I hunted dove. That was about the only bird that I ever hunted. And, you know, then I would hunt squirrel and stuff like that. But, you know, listening to you guys talk about this, I kind of feel like that bringing a young person up into hunting, that bird hunting is a great way to instill discipline into a shooter. Into a young hunter saying, okay, you got to make that decision and pick and pull when you're going to make the shot. It's not all just bang, 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 you know. And
especially with pheasants, you have to identify whether it's a male or female. You can only shoot roosters most times. So
yeah,
there's a lot to man. It. Yep. And then we talked about it briefly, too, the dogs. Anytime you have a dog, if you've got a pointing dog, typically your dog is going to go on point, and you can pick the next person up to go up and be the first shot. It's this particular case I was referring to, the bird flushed wild, and it was a free-for-all, you know. So you were going to say something, Randy?
Yeah, I was just going to say with birds, there oftentimes you do kind of have those lanes and the Vs that they do intersect at points. And so just learning to be courteous and humble when a bird drops, because, you know, at first everybody, you know, is kind of, that my bird, my bird, my bird, and then eventually it gets kind of, you know that guy's not a very good shot, but let him have the bird, man. You know, let him get his confidence up. Let him be a part of the party. But that's just something that I think, especially quail hunting, they're so fast and they're so hard to hit that if two people fire, just let them have it. Because it's not worth getting in an argument for. You're there to have a good time.
And I always let them have it so I can shoot.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, dude, that's your bird, because now I got one more that I can shoot, because I know you
missed. I used to get so butthurt dove hunting when I was younger. I used to get so upset because I would shoot. I know I hit a bird in these public freaking fields, and this guy would come snag my bird, you know. But in reality, heck, I know I hit it, but I get to keep shooting. As long as I get to bring a little meat home, I'm happy.
Yeah, exactly.
I agree. Well, let's get right into this. Let's start talking about it. We've been talking about dove hunting. Dove hunting is typically, in my opinion, the best hunt to introduce a new young person to. There's really no walking involved. They can sit in a chair. They can, you know, sit there with their parents. It's fun for them to go out and pick it up and see this. It's also a good chance. Last year I had a chance to take my daughter. She was 4 and a half out for the very first time, and it was the first time that I had a chance to talk to her about life and death.
Yeah.
I don't know if any of you guys, I know, John, you take your boys out, probably the same thing as seeing something die for the first time and explaining to them why we as hunters do it. Do you guys agree?
Sure.
Absolutely,
I agree.
Man.
I came home from school today, and Adam said he saw a dove on the wire coming home from the school bus. He said, Dad, it looks so big and juicy. I'm like, yeah, we'll get some this weekend. It was awesome.
Dove sandwich. That's good stuff. No, man, go ahead. And then well,
go for it.
I was
going
to say,
go
like, I completely believe in instilling this type of bringing a child into the outdoors and into hunting as early as they can understand it. And being able to explain that to them the right way, because if you don't do it, somebody else you don't trust is going to. They're gonna understand life and death at some point in their life, and it's better to come from their parent in the right way than some stranger or the television that you see.
100%.
So.
Yeah.
And plus, there's no better feeling than your kid bragging that their dad's better than everybody else in the field. Like, I had that. We dove season here started 2 days ago in California, and I know pretty much nationwide where it starts this Saturday. But first bird in the field, I drop, and my daughter looked at everyone else in the field and goes, "My daddy shoots better than you." And there's no better compliment in the world than your little five-year-old girl telling every other guy in the field that their dad shoots better. And I was like, "You're right, I do."
Yeah, you're not no humbleness here.
Oh, heck no. Especially when your five-year-old girl says it, you feel like you're the king, and your princess just, you know, told you that you got $1 million.
Proud,
so.
Papa, man.
That's right. So let's talk about some tips and tricks. Let's start off with shooting. What are some tips on actually holding the gun? I think that's the biggest thing that I've found teaching people how to hunt.
I mean, I think cheek placement, man. I think, like, you know, like if you shoot archery, everything's about mechanics. I think the same thing goes into your gun. You can't just throw that thing to your shoulder and expect to hit something. You got to have proper mechanics while you're out in the field every single time. You do the same thing every single time correctly, you're going to have a lot more success than of doing a bunch of sky busting.
I think the main thing with birds specifically is to lead the bird. To lead it, you know, depends on how fast they're going. You'll judge that as you learn. But a lot of people point the gun up, pull the trigger, and put it down, see if they shot the bird. And they want to follow through on that shot. And it's one of the number one tips you can do as a wing shooter, clay birds. It all matters. Just come through the target, follow through, pull the trigger.
I think that's where a lot of people make the mistake, is with the follow through. The lack of that just, like, either pulls the shot up, pulls it down, right, left, and just kind of it kills it.
Yeah, I mean, that going, like, getting on the bird, pulling the trigger, and stopping where you pulled the trigger. You know, the bird's
number
gone.
One bad habit. Yeah, number one bad habit.
So I was out this weekend. I had two brand new hunters, both in their 30s and 40s. So older gentlemen coming in with already bad habits from shooting clays and shooting other things. And it was my job to try to break their bad habit. And that's the biggest thing that I saw is, like, I was teaching them, like I was taught, when you're shooting a shotgun, you don't aim your shotgun. You're not sitting there aiming at the bird. You're looking at the bird. You're keeping those eyes open. You're looking at the bird, and you're following through. Because, like the other guys are saying, when you stop that shot, your spread is stopping. But if you follow through, you're actually following that bird where it's flying, and you'll be able to drop it a lot faster than if you're sitting there waiting for the bird and following it with your gun. If you listen to professional shooters at, like, in the Olympics, their biggest thing is what they say is that your eye follows the fastest and closest thing moving.
Yeah.
So if you're focusing on your gun, the fastest and closest thing is the barrel of your gun. You're not focused on your bird. But if you focus your eyes on the bird, where you're looking is where your gun is.
I'll tell you an easy tip for me, too, that helps me, is that when I'm holding the front end of my gun, I point my finger. Yeah, I point my finger at the target I'm at, you know. And instinctively, when you point your finger like that, your brain wants to follow your finger. And so for me, that helps me drop a lot more birds.
The other thing I would say, too, is a lot of times birds, whether they're quail, pheasants, doves, they're flying a lot slower than you think they are, and a lot of people will tend to overlead them.
Yeah.
Or if something flushes or gets up from behind you, there's plenty of time to get ready, and a lot of people rush the shot. And just know that, you know, there's more birds coming, and take your time and get your cheek down on the stock, like Joel said, and take your time.
Yep.
Yeah, I think one thing that I was always taught is it's the forefinger. Is an average bird lead is four fingers. So if you're looking at the bird, you've got your average bird, your bird is four fingers with your shotgun. For the average bird that's out there that that's flying the crossover shots. The coming and the going away, it's a little bit different. But when you're doing those crossover shots, if you imagine those 3 to 4 fingers, you're going to pretty much be right on point. Now, there are takes in other variables. Don't sit there and go, well, Jeremiah said 4 fingers, I'm going to hit every single shot. Again, I've clocked dove flying at 37 miles an hour on the car next to me. So they can book it
they
if they want to.
They got a max speed, I think, where their top speed is like over right over 60 miles an hour.
African or European?
Is it a African swallow or a European swallow? I'll tell you another good tip. Just shoot you about 3 or 4 boxes of shells, and eventually you're gonna figure it out. That's what I used to do.
Yeah, don't
practice. Right?
No,
it's just called practice. That's my biggest thing. It's every
right.
year.
You're no, you're honing.
Go out to the range.
You're honing in your skills.
No. You just go right out in the field with a brand new gun and just throw in a shell and just try to do it. You know,
it's just an animal. You're just
with your new Benelli.
Sorry, Randy. Go ahead, man. Sorry.
No, man. It's just going out and shooting, you know, a box of shells and a box of clays before season starts. You know,
yeah.
And I would gun up because people spend that whole summer, that whole spring, they ain't shot anything since they shot a turkey, you know, in April, right? And they've been
you shot a turkey. I didn't shoot a turkey.
We got some turkeys this year. We did pretty good, but you ain't shot since then. And then you had a tight wad choke in or something like that. So it's not having shot for so long. Just get back in, get that routine again, figure out how to remember how to shoot. And break some shells and some clay, and then you're back on the horse. You know, it's
exactly, man. Yeah.
Because anytime I forget like that, I know those first few quail or the first box of shells on quail usually is like, it's just embarrassing. You know. I'm blaming my gun. You know, I'm blaming my dog. I'm blaming all sorts of stuff, but it's really my fault because I just haven't practiced.
I just tell them I'm keeping the birds flying for them. Is all I do.
I would say for new wing shooters, especially with doves. To give you a general idea, your good shooters, your good seasoned hunter is going to shoot 3.5 to 5 times per bird. So to go out there your first year, and if you shoot 4 to 7 times to drop a bird on average, you're right where you're supposed to be. And then just work on lowering that year after year. I'm at the point now where I only take 2 boxes out with me. And if I don't limit out, then I don't limit out. I just need to shoot better the next time. But you have your good days and bad days, just like anything else. But know that, you know, you're going to drop some.
Brother, if I don't have 2 bricks, I ain't going.
My dad's rule of thumb is a box of birds. So
I wish I had your old confidence.
Let's keep going with that. Let's talk about plucking versus breasting. And I know when it talk about dove are little itty-bitty things. My wife calls them our dove nuggets because that's all you're getting off a breast is a nugget. So let's talk about what are your guys' opinions. I know a lot of us have done this. We've done both, and we enjoy both. But let's get it from everybody. Let's start over there with Justin. What's your idea? Which do you prefer, plucking or breasting those suckers out?
I think it depends on the amount we have. First off, obviously, if we've got a whole mess of doves, plucking sort of drops on the priority chain. But, you know, in regards to cooking, I'm a stock guy. I like to make stock, so I like to try to keep as much of the bird as I can. So usually I'll go through and plucking. You know, I think I have been plucking dove and, you know, birds longer than I realized that you could just take off the breast meat and leave the rest. I remember my grandpa teaching me when I was, you know, probably before I was a teenager, and we plucked the whole dove, you know, cleaned it out, and he takes the heart. He's like, oh, hey, you want to eat this? And I'm like, no, I'm good. And pops it in his mouth. And so always in my head, I think back to that. I'm like, oh, you got to pluck the whole bird just because tradition, that's the way I was taught. So I'm a pluck guy.
I ate a dove heart one time, and that sucker was just like Elmer's glue in my mouth.
Dude.
It was so dry and pasty, man. It was all the moisture gone.
Fun story. One of those guys that I took out for the very first time, he brought his 7-year-old son, and we're sitting there cleaning the birds, and I was putting the hearts in a pile because I like to saute them up, some garlic and butter, and they're delicious, or a little bit of teriyaki sauce and saute them up. And I look over, and he's just sitting there popping them in like M&Ms.
Yes.
This little 7-year-old kid. And he had like 25 hearts. And he's like, you have any more hearts? And I'm like, dude, did you just eat 25 raw hearts? He's like, they're so good. And I was just cracking up. And my little 5-year-old daughter's like, well, if he wants to
eat
them, I want to eat them. And I was like, yeah. I was like, oh, my gosh. I can't believe you just ate 25 raw hearts. But again, you know, sorry. I know it's off topic. But you're talking about hearts. And I was laughing at the 7-year-old who just popped a million hearts in his mouth. So how about you, Randy? What are your thoughts on plucking versus breasting?
You know, usually I'm a plucker for the most part, but then like Justin said, if you know you got a buck, it kind of changes. So I'll actually skin them. So it's a little, you know, you just grab the back. You reach underneath with your fingernails and you basically just pull the breast right off. The two wings come, right? And then you can take, with the other hand, basically just grab what's left and just pull down on it. And then you got the leg skinned. So you're sitting there with the backbone and two skinned legs. And I'll take that and make stock, or I'll simmer that and that little meat will kind of come off. And then I'll have basically the breast meat still attached to the breast bone and stuff like that. With the two wings, I'll just take a pair of kitchen shears and shear those off. Yeah. And then I've got kind of two separate applications, right? Then I've got my dove nuggets, as you're calling them. And then I got my stuff for stock and for soup and stuff like that.
Huh.
So it's pretty quick, which is nice, you know?
Yeah. When I was growing up, my dad always said the only tool you need to clean a dove is your thumb. And it's always stuck with me. It's always how I teach people. Like you were saying, shove that thumb right between the breastbone underneath, and you can actually follow the breastbone all the way up. And like he was saying, it's almost like I always tell people when they're new, think about archery. When you pull back on your bow, if you grab both sides of that bird and pull back like you're pulling a bow, you'll do exactly what Randy said. You'll pull that bird right in half. You'll have a breast with two wings, and you'll have a backbone and two legs. So,
and then it's just one more motion, and that whole thing is now featherless. You know, just carry a pair of kitchen shears and just clip off the feet, you know?
Oh, yeah. You can do 15 birds in 30 seconds if you're good at it.
See, man. I want to meet that guy.
I want to take that guy.
Prove it.
All right. I will, next dove hunt, I will prove that I can do 15 birds in 30 seconds.
See, this, like, I've never, like, I guess I'm old school Southern where everybody just eats the daggum breasts. But, all I've ever done with dove is, take the wings and I twist them off, and then I take my two thumbs and I just put it in the middle of the breast and I just peel that skin back, and then it leaves the breast exposed, and then I pop my thumb underneath there and just pull the whole thing out. That's only way I've ever been taught how to clean dove. And I know stuff Randy was talking about, man, that's gnarly. Like, to get the two separate applications out of the dove, I mean, talk about getting everything you can get out of a bird. I mean, that's pretty cool, dude.
Well, yeah, but then you always got the ones you shot a little too hard. You know, maybe they were a little too close or something. And then
the one where you go, I didn't shoot that one. Yeah. I didn't shoot that one.
For sure. So they can get a little grisly. That's the one where you got one BB in his head and you're just lucky to have it. So.
Yeah, well, that's usually mine are 10 feet away and full of shot, so... About as good as I get.
The dove is the only one with me that gets a free pass with myself and others to breast it out. I'm definitely this year going to start utilizing more of the whole bird, with a lot of the inspiration from you guys and some of the others. But, you know, with other game, I'm trying to use the legs, the thighs, the innards, and so on. I definitely am going to try dove hearts this fall now, just within the last 5 minutes here.
Amazing.
So. Absolutely. But yeah, it's up to you, to each their own, what they want to do, especially if they're new into it. You know, breasting the bird on a dove is fine with me. It's acceptable, you know, so.
Especially because they're
late. Yeah, if you want to use them for stock or something like that.
It's like trying to milk a kitten.
Right.
Yeah. It's just really hard.
Yep.
So, all right, well, continue with that, John. I know that you're really passionate about dove, so. Let's go ahead and have you kind of tell us a little bit about why you like dove hunting, and then give us a recipe, man.
Sure. Well, I started out dove hunting on public land with, controlled hunts. There's guys every 30 yards from you. Luckily for me, I started out with a lot of birds, in fields where there's just birds everywhere. And you learn right away, like we talked about earlier, if someone wants that bird and you know you shot it, hey, there's going to be a lot more birds. Let him get his limit and get out of the field so you can enjoy the hunt and get yours. The other thing I did mention is take those short shots. So if those doves are flying at 30 yards plus, or they're 50 yards in the air, you may fling a BB up there and once in a while and drop one, but etiquette to others in the field. So I was told in my first hunt, I was reaching out there trying to touch them, was, you better make sure you can see their eye, their eyeball before you can pull the trigger. And you're not really looking at that, but it gives you a sense of how close they should be. And you'll also start to notice that you're not into that third box of shells. You're going to stick within two boxes or maybe even get to one box when you're dropping them at 20 yards or 15 yards. So another tip and trick that we talked about was a mojo dove. I don't know if we had brought that up, but mojo dove, robo dove, whatever you want to call it with the motorized wings, will suck doves into your spot, your location from hundreds of yards away. So not a plug for them, but hey, they do work. So a lot of hunters around us readily utilize those, and it works if you don't have a lot of birds in your field.
So you think those?
So let's talk. Let's talk about that real quick. Why do?
All right. So
doves
the motion. They see the motion. They come over the ridge line. They come over the hill. They come into the field from a tree line, and they see that movement, and it appears as if there's a flock of doves or a dove landing in the field. They say, "Hey, there's my buddy Jeremiah over there. I'm gonna go there and land over there." And when he does. You know, you tell him hello.
Little do they know.
Yeah, you tell him hello, you reach out and touch him, you know. So some people will tell you that when they're coming into those mojos real low, they're actually harder to hit because they blend in with the horizon. But, man, they really work. And sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. So those duck hunters listening to this show, some days you use your mojo duck and some days you turn it off. So if it's not working.
So another thing, another reason that they work is that doves usually most of the time, they find one mate. Or they'll stick with that mate for an entire season. So if you have a solo dove flying and they see another dove, their instinct is to go and be with somebody else. They don't want to be a solitary animal. So using those decoys, as the doves are flying over, they went, oh, that's someone for safety, as well as someone that maybe I can spend the rest of my year with. And so it does, like you were saying, bring those
people
in.
So, John, do you think it's worth the preparation of setting up decoys or mojo doves when you're dove hunting as opposed to just going and climbing in a pile of corn stalks and hiding waiting for them to eat?
That's a great question, and I'll give you a good answer, I think. So I think the mojo dove is without question worth taking and setting up. I've got some additional hard-bodied stationary decoys, and I took them with me on the opener. I didn't use them because there's plenty of birds. And even if there wasn't, I don't think they bring in near as much as what that single mojo dove does. However, if I've got my 6 and 5-year-old boys with me, and I've got 6 to 8 of those hard body decoys, you bet I'm taking them, and you bet we're using them because they're going to go out there, you know, put them where they want, attach them to sticks. You know, hey, the doves aren't flying, you know, go out there and move the decoys a little bit, and they can go out there and mess with them. So the boys.
That's a great idea. Keeping the young ones, not letting them get bored. If you're having a slow hunt, so they're not getting burnt out on it. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, but not sky busting. You know, sky busting's a term that a lot of hunters, whether they're duck hunters or wing shooters, mainly doves and ducks, let those birds get close. If they're not close enough for you, they'll try to get close to someone else. But that's a big pet peeve by a lot of your hunters in the field is shooting at birds you don't have the ability to drop down on a consistent basis. Just shoot them close, and you'll have a good hunt. You'll save some money. And it'll be a good time for all in the field. So that's kind of my tips, tricks.
Make me hungry.
All right. So years of dove hunting. I started dove hunting kind of later in my career. Grew up like Joel, squirrel, deer hunting. And I got introduced to doves by marinating them in teriyaki, throwing a piece of jalapeno, maybe even a little Vidalia onion, and wrapping them in bacon and grilling them up. And it's like nothing you've ever had. It's the best thing you've ever eaten until you realize that there's a lot of other options out there. But one of the things that really kicked off my wild game cooking career, if you will, in the kitchen was just trying to find a new way to spice up that bacon wrapped dove. So I've got like an Asian more inspired. It's like the teriyaki on steroids, and you throw in some ginger powder or fresh ginger, garlic, some brown sugar, some honey, and, you know, a little spice, throwing some red chili flakes. I like the chili flakes because they're a little bit more controlled heat versus the jalapeno. And then you can candy glaze it if you want, you know. But I think we're going to be posting recipes later of that so you guys can take a look at it.
On the From Field to Plate blog, we're going to have all these recipes posted. So as soon as the podcast hits, the blog will be up. And you can go over to fromfieldtoplate.com with links back to everyone's websites, and the recipes will be posted there with pictures. It'll be super delicious. So let's move on to quail. Quail are super similar to dove. Thanks, John, for that recipe. I've got a ton of dove in my freezer that I'll be trying those with. So quail. quail are a little bit different. They're small, just like that dove, but you get to flush them just like your pheasant. So I think it's that now we've stepped up to that next level of getting into a little more sporting aspect when it comes to it, because you're not staying there waiting for the bird to come to you. You're actually pursuing your game, but it's still a great hunt to have your youth out on because you're walking with them, but it's not too extreme, and they get to see birds flush, and there's no better feeling than your kid grabbing the side of your pant leg when the birds, you know, hit that stride, and there's that sound like a 747 taking off when they all fly. So I think some tips and tricks are the same, kind of goes with the dove, but I know that, like, again, John, I'm going to bounce back to you since this is what you do with Quail Forever. What are some tips and tricks that you, again, share with those people during this quail seminar?
Sure. So the main thing is the dog. Most times you're hunting quail with dogs, pointing dogs most times. So that means the dog is going to smell the bird, smell the covey. They're going to go on point and let you know that there's birds in front of his or her nose. And the main thing you need to do as a hunter is always know where the dog is. And you're never shooting low birds because it's all about the dog. You don't want to shoot your dog or one of your friends' dogs. That won't go over well. And with that, you make sure you're ready because they will jump up at your feet. And I experienced my first covey rise here 2 years ago, and it's like nothing I've ever seen. Your heart gets going, and you got to try to find one of these little rockets, you know, flying around you, and pick one bird, stay with it, and lead it, fairly well, and hopefully you'll drop a couple. But we had already talked about, I think, your zones, and a lot of times if you're working with a pointing dog, you'll be able to go over to that dog, flush the birds, and have your opportunity to shoot. I think that's about it.
So some things with quails too is quails are runners. These are runner birds. Be like John was saying, be wise to not shoot the ones
and
on
I
the
would
ground.
Say in the Midwest, okay. The bobwhite quail, which is what we have in our region and in Joel's region, are more so flyers. They're going to stay put until they're flushed, and then they're going to flush again. So
okay.
Not like your desert quail, California quail, which what you're speaking to is 100% true, and I can't speak to that realm. That's your expertise. But yes, you never want to shoot. Whenever you're hunting with a dog, you're never shooting on the ground unless you're rabbit hunting, and then again, you always want to know where that dog is. So
let me ask you, let me interject for just a second. So you guys talked about zones a minute ago, and so the zone, let's say I'm out there in the field, I'm a new, which I am, I've never done it. So I'm out there in the field, and I'm hunting, and, bird flies up. How do I know between me and this other guy or female that's next to me, that is my bird or their bird?
So here's the deal. With quail, a lot of that goes out the window because there's so many of them, and they're so hard to come by. So it's kind of shoot and, sort them out later. And with quail, you don't need to know whether they're male or female or not. You just, as a hunter, you should always know the basic safety rules, which is know your target and beyond. So if you're shooting at a bird, you want to make sure there's not another hunting party 100, 200, 300 yards ahead of you. There's no houses, no buildings, things of that nature. And you should always know where your parties are left to right, so you're never swinging out of your zone. But as far as with quail, they'll tell you that a lot of those rules with etiquette go out the window. When they flush, it's every man, woman, child for themselves.
Yeah, because in my experience, when quail flush, they don't flush in the same direction. They're scattering.
Like a bomb going off.
Imagine, think about a firework. Okay, a firework is stationary until something causes it to explode. So those quail are stationary until something causes it to explode. And a firework never explodes all to the right or all to the left unless it's set that way. It's going to explode in all these different ways. So when I've been quail hunting with three guys and a dog is when the dog is on point and we say, get bird, and that dog jumps that bush. I mean, you've got quail flying left, right, up, down, running on the ground. You've got them going over your head. You got them going away. You got them crossing over. And it becomes where, again, you're safely identifying your target and taking your shot. There's been times where I'm shooting to the left, my dad's shooting to the right, my brother's shooting straight above us, and then the dog's going, which bird do I pick up? So, and again, being aware of where your bird drops.
Would you say that quail hunting is kind of, etiquette-wise, is similar to dove hunting? It's just like if the bird's in your view and you're being coherent about what's in your shooting vision, then it's first come, first serve. You get that bird, then that's your bird, whatever. It's not like, okay, hey, that bird was in my zone kind of a thing. It's just free for all.
No, it's right, because you're not getting on a single bird like a grouse,
right,
or like a pheasant where you're like, okay, John, I shot the last one. This is your bird. Get over to the dog. Dog, get bird. No, it's an average covey can be anywhere between 20 and 30 birds. At least in California.
Ours is probably 12 to 20 to 30. So, but the difference is there's also two zones here. There's a safety zone, which is your 45 degree angles away from you, and then there's the zone in which the birds are flying. So if you have a covey of quail get up, there's a left, center, and right. So if there's three of you, you're all shooting straight ahead, but Joel's shooting the bird on the left, I'm shooting the one in the center, and Jeremiah, Randy, and Justin are shooting at the birds on the right. So
I'm not going to swing across.
Because we're better shots.
That way you're both not shooting at the same dove and you both drop it. You know, the guy on the right should never be dropping a bird on the left. And it applies to mallards, you know, anything of that nature. You want to shoot your zone, what's the word I'm looking for, like your hypothetical zone.
Right.
And that's why I was saying it when I was the right, my dad was the left, my brother was to the center, even though we were standing shoulder length together. Mm-hmm. But we were all shooting birds because my dad would never shoot my birds flying, and because we're crossing over in front of my brother who's in the middle, and we're all in a row and safely, it can be shot that way because
and that kind of comes naturally too, you know, in a way. I mean, it's like, you know, I'm on the left, the closest bird to me is on the left, you know, I'm not going to swing all the way across trying to shoot a bird that's farther away from me as well. So,
but you do have those guys that are going to do that. And that's where the etiquette comes in, and that's where teaching and control. Because I took these guys out dove hunting, and we were standing 10 feet apart. And I'm trying to teach them, and a dove is to my right, and they're to my left, and he starts to aim at the dove that's to my right. So not only is he 10 feet to my left, but that dove is 10 yards to my right, and he's still going to try to shoot the dove past me.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? And it was one of those deals where I'm like, hey, so I let the dove fly by, and I sat down and had a very long conversation with a 40-year-old man about zones and safety. So,
good deal, man.
I think the same thing goes with plucking and breasting quail. Quails are going to be a little bit bigger, I think all of us are going to agree that we all have our plucking and breasting.
And I would say I'm more of a whole bird quail guy, you know, just because they're so much harder to get for me that I'm going to utilize as much as I can out of that. But if I do have a crop full of quail, you know, maybe there may be other applications, but their
little thighs are so tasty. That's the best part of a quail is those little thighs, like sitting on like a little ear of corn.
Best birds there are.
Justin, what are your thoughts?
I'm definitely a pluck guy with quails. I mean, primary reason I came across a method sort of, I guess, post plucking after or when you're getting ready to prepare your dish. It's semi-boning. Basically, you're taking off.
Is that video of that girl with the scissors?
Yeah, you essentially.
She's so hot. Sorry, wife. I know my wife's listening. I'm sorry.
It's cool because you're doing everything with scissors and just your hands, but you're just clipping the backbone on either side of the backbone and then pulling out the wishbone and then sort of running your thumb along the rib cage and then just clipping the last joint, and then the rib cage, all the bones are popped free. You have one bone coming out of the breast and sort of everything's just kind of butterflied open in front of you. It's really easy to cook with, and the bone, the ribs, and all the, you know, the trimmings you can sort of keep for a stock, or, you know, if you want to like try to stew and pick off meat or whatever to use everything. But it's easy to roast it. Pan fry, do whatever you want with it. That's kind of the best. So leading with,
and I'll go ahead and post that video of that girl we're talking about on the blog as well.
You do that maybe right now, sir.
Son. Maybe when quail season starts here, we'll even do our own, where we can do that. I know Justin and I live very close to each other. We can do our own, and you guys can get a good-looking dude.
Can I ask you guys a quick question before Justin jumps into his delicious recipe? Making stock out of dove and quail, like how many birds do you have to have in order to make stock from those little tiny bones?
Damn it, Randy, you can take this. Justin, you can take this. I can take this. I've done it. Justin's done it. Randy, I know you've done it. John has not. It's all about pulling the flavor from the bones. So I know, Justin, you just posted a great recipe on that. So Randy, I know I've seen some stuff that you've done also.
Yeah, I just actually on Wednesday we just put a post together, but it pulls off of Escoffier's sort of like traditional recipe. Escoffier is like the culinary master of the professional kitchen, and he's got a sort of poultry wild game or wild poultry recipe, I guess you could call it, where you're using basically like 13 to 15, and it's kind of unclear if it's whole or if it's just the carcasses or what have you. But I mean, you're looking, you need a good mess of dove or, you know, quail, pheasant, you know, larger, so it's a little easier to manage. But to get, you know, a gallon worth of stock, you're going to need between 15 to 20 dove probably.
So you would need basically a limit of dove to get you a decent portion of stock. And then like with pheasant or something, that's a little bit larger of a bird. You'd think like two or three of those would two.
Think about it as exactly. A chicken. If you're making chicken stock, you're using two whole chickens. Cool. And they're the, Randy, what are your thoughts?
About 2 pounds worth of stuff, pound and a half, 2 pounds worth of bones.
Yeah. So the average thing is most stocks are going to break down by at a minimum of 25%.
How clean do you have to get it?
Well, you're going to strain it. You're going to strain it later. You can, I mean, as long as the feathers are off, that's kind of the rule of thumb. You don't want feathers floating there. As long as feathers are off, you can pretty much get away with putting anything into that stock. You can put your gizzards. You can put your livers. You can put, you know, your hearts. You can put your backbones. And what I typically like to do is, so I was out with six guys. Limit here in California is 15 birds, helping everyone limit out and doing this stuff. Is you can take, because most guys are going to breast out their bird, you can take all that extra trimmings that they just threw away, and you'll have more than enough to make your stock. So, and it's delicious because you can season it however you want to season it, and it freezes phenomenally. Like every year I make turkey stock, pheasant stock, dove and quail stock, and I've got a freezer full of it, and that's, I don't use chicken stock anymore.
I think
anymore.
That should be a future topic we talk about, how to use stocks.
I could use a lot of help with that,
stocks and bonds.
Justin make us hungry, bro.
Okay, so quail recipe, we're doing roasted quail with a sage and cornbread dressing. Ooh. So down here in Southern California, of course, we have a ton of sage, so sort of trying to utilize local flavors with, you know, locally harvested birds. Quail is going to be pretty straightforward. Just you're going to season, you know, as I said, we're going to follow that semi-boning method, which Jeremiah is going to post a video. Once you have that, you're going to use just a regular box of Jiffy cornbread and just bake that up following the directions. And then the seasonings are going to be pretty straightforward. You're going to use fresh sage, onion. I like to throw in squash. I'm a big squash fan. So just, you know, finely chopped up in there with some onions, butter, and water. And then just like you do your dressing for turkey, it's going to be the same thing, except for you're going to season the quail, you know, with whatever seasonings that you prefer. I personally like Cajun seasoning, so I'll do that. And then just throw it all in a cast iron pan, put the quail on top, put it in the oven about 350 for about 15, 20 minutes.
You know what I love about that, what I just heard about that recipe, is when you said Jiffy cornbread. but seriously, talk about keeping it, that meal sounded amazing, but keeping it simple, you know, because for me, I can go to freaking Wally World, grab me some Jiffy cornbread and
for 49 cents a box.
And try this mug if I ever go quail hunting.
Oh, dude, you can do it with dove too.
I mean, you could even do it with pheasant. The only thing is just you want to make sure that you're going to cook the pheasant a little more before you put it in with the dressing, and you just want to make sure you're cooking it all the way through.
Very nice.
So a quick tip on a lot of these too. A lot of people like to cook their upland game birds differently. Just kind of that rule of thumb is 160. Just be safe. You can cook it less. You can cook it more. But 160 is kind of your cook temp on most of this stuff. So like he was saying about cooking that pheasant, because everything else is going to cook faster than a bigger bird.
And
so,
you don't think it doesn't get dry? I mean, like, I know, like, chicken and stuff, you want to definitely get up to that point, but that's a fatter, meatier bird.
Well, your dove are going to hit 160 way before you think they are.
Yeah.
People overcook their small birds way faster. I mean, I could put a thermometer in a dove breast and hit 160 in, you know, a couple minutes. And people are like, oh, it's still not cooked all the way through, which it is, and it's delicious. Yeah. But that's where people get the problem, is they start drying it out because they're like, oh, it's still kind of it's still pink. Well, it's dark.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, man. Like, you've got to – like you said this on our last get-together. You said, you know, if you give, you know, burgers love, it'll love you back. I think that's with everything you cook. You got to love it, man, and don't be so – don't rack your brain on all the details so much that, okay, it's got to be at this pH and, you know, at this degree, at this temp for this long. And if I don't do it exactly like this, then it's not done.
Yeah. I'm going to die.
I mean, just cook the food. Just cook the food and love it. And when you feel like it's done, and like Jeremiah, you said, you stick a little thermometer in there and it's right there at that temp, pull them suckers off and just eat the daggum things.
Yeah, let them rest and pop in your mouth. Let's change subjects real quick. We've been talking about birds, and in the category of upland game is small game. All of us, when we get our tags, most of us included in our upland game stamp is our small game stamp. And in that includes rabbit and squirrel. So let's kind of talk about rabbit and squirrel for a little bit and get off the birds. We'll get back to birds, don't worry, because pheasant and grouse are some of my favorite hunt. But let's talk about rabbits. Let's talk about some tips and tricks that go into rabbit hunting. I know, Joel, you were saying in Tennessee that you guys can't hunt rabbits.
Man, it's November until we can hunt rabbits, and then the season ends in at the end of February up here. And it's the craziest thing, man. I tell you, these rabbits up here, when it's hunting season, you can't find a daggum rabbit. But as soon as the spring hits and then flowers pop out, I got 10 of them in my dang backyard. So I got questions about that.
Same here in Missouri. Same season dates as Joel over there.
Yeah.
How about Randy? How about you?
September 1st through February 28th. So that's nice. We got a lot longer season. And we also have the big jackrabbits out here. So we got the black-tailed jackrabbits and the white-tailed jackrabbits. And those are a non-game species. So you can hunt them year-round. So rabbit hunting out here is a big, big sport. You have access year-round.
Yeah, in California we got July 1st.
Yeah, jackrabbits open all year. I think it's
cottontails are July 1st through February. Rabbits are one of the only animals I use gloves to clean because of all the bacteria and disease and stuff like that. Like, I'm all about getting my hands bloody and dirty and getting guts underneath my nails when I'm doing other things. But growing up and learning about rabbits are one of the only animals that I use gloves with.
Y'all know that.
Just because of
that, the bloodless trick, basically, where you can just squeeze them out.
Oh, flip it underneath. Yeah, you can squeeze it like a sock or like a toothpaste bottle. Right, Randy? Is that what you're talking about?
You just crush the ribs and it squeezes everything down the bottom and take it over your head and swing it between your legs.
Hey, this is a YouTube another thing, video as well.
They're out there.
Oh, it is. So you can grab it right there. So there's the head. Grab right at the neck. And kind of it's just like milking a cow. If you never milked a cow, take that finger, roll it all the way down, crack those ribs, and squeeze it like a toothpaste bottle. And you can go between your legs. You can flick it over your head. And all that stuff will pop right out. You can also turn it in like
hemorrhoids.
So you can actually pull the skin off like a banana. And that you can take that skin, bring it all the way down to the end. And you can actually tie a knot where the neck is. And squeeze all the guts into that bag, into the skin itself, if you're not saving the skin, and pull it right off, and then discard that skin. I'll make a YouTube video this year of it, because that's something my dad does, is squeezes it all into it, and then you're talking about the dogs. Everything is in that little sack of skin that you had, with no knife even needed, because of the way that you can actually that happen. So we'll make sure we get one of those for you. So I think that answers some of our field dressing and summer words and... But let's talk about butchering real quick before we get into an amazing recipe by Randy. What are some of your guys' favorite techniques on butchering rabbits? Do we bone in, bone out, quarter? How do you guys like to do it?
I like to bone in with it. I basically like just take the rabbit itself and I like to quarter it. I don't keep anything on the ribs. I like the tenderloins and I like the front and rear quarters is normally what I'll keep off of a rabbit.
How about you, John?
I don't kill too many rabbits. I just don't take the opportunity to get out much. But I'm
because you're not good at
well,
it.
You suck. Do you suck at rabbit hunting?
Just admit
no.
it, John.
I'm trying to fill the freezer with deer a lot of times during that season, but I hope to get out more this year. But I'm typically like Joel. I use all four quarters, the tenderloins on the back. I do kind of use the belly meat. You know, I'll kind of fry it up a little bit. You know, a little chef's treat there as I'm cooking it up. It typically doesn't make to the table. Mm. And I can make stock. I've made stock a couple times. You know, just try to best utilize it. But I've done bone in, bone out. But I try to keep it pretty simple. That's about it.
I do love the liver and the heart, though, on a rabbit. It is fantastic.
Especially when they're spotted with white.
That's
mm.
you guys, it really gets the taste buds to go in.
Y'all ever do the
what's up, Randy?
Do the roulade where you kind of just debone the whole thing and cape it all out? That's like an old school, like culinary school sort of thing that you got to do. But you start with the legs. You just bone out the legs and go in around on the belly meat and fold it down under. And then go on down the rib cage, take out the tenderloins, and keep it all as one big caped out piece. And then you can roll that up,
stuff it, roll
it up. And you fry it, you do whatever you want. And then
you guys are fancy.
No, it's actually that's the first way I learned how to do a rabbit was because I was told if you're gonna do a rabbit, you gotta learn the hardest way first. And exactly right. I mean, fleshing that sucker out to make a turducken style. You know, different animals stuffed in with it to a different animal. But yeah, you roll it up just like you would like a burrito or rolling up like a tenderloin or rolling up like something like that. And it's phenomenal. You cut into it, it's moist because you've got that stuff in that filling in there.
Got different textures
how about
stuff.
You, Justin?
My mouth
oh, yeah.
is drying.
All I can say is challenge accepted.
Get it, bud. Get it, son.
Prove it.
So right. I like, you know, rabbit season opens early here in California. It's usually the first thing we can get in the field and do. So I'm always trying to, if I get a rabbit, I want to use the whole thing. So I'm going to do quarter. I'm going to pull the tenderloins off and I'm going to keep all the meat on the ribs and on the spine and everything. That's going to go for stock. The quarters I'll usually roast or batter and fry. I've made rabbit chili. I've ground it up. I've done different things. I mean, it just depends on what I'm feeling at the time, honestly.
Wow.
Yeah, my dad always does a rabbit Christmas stew. He'll take two or three rabbits, throw it in a stew, and he'll let that thing simmer all day long. And then on Christmas, you just get into it, and it's phenomenal. So speaking about food, we're all getting tasty. I want to go shoot a rabbit right now. Randy, go ahead and hit us with your rabbit recipe.
Sure. So jackrabbits aren't known for being tender. They're
they're not.
They've got this reputation, a well-deserved one. And so what I did, I got a little frisky and decided I was going to can some food. And I got a Craigslist and I found this Victory canner from World War II. So the thing is seriously, it's aluminum. It's just this hardcore looking canner. I cracked that thing open.
I saw the picture. It looked like a World War II.
Oh yeah, hold on. It's got
like a lung machine.
Oh, yeah,
dude.
It's got the V for victory thing on it. The whole bit from World War II. It's awesome. So I broke this sucker out and I took some jackrabbits, deboned them, browned them off, threw a little chicken stock on top of them, and now I've got the shelf stable. And you got to pressure can it is what it is. So now I've got the shelf stable little jars of like fajita meat that I made up that are just perfect for like one dude's tacos for dinner. So I do a lot of backpacking hunting and stuff like that. So I cracked into one the next day, and it's just fork tender jackrabbit. It's amazing. So now I've got these like 16 of these little vials that I can take with me, throw them in the bottom of my backpack, and tromps around out in the woods with some tortillas and have a good rabbit, you know, fajita whenever I want one. So,
Randy, you are freaking bringing it, son. You got awesome equipment, badass freaking recipe, dude. You're like, I'm loving you right now.
Well, let's go ahead and stop right there, boys. We will continue this topic on upland and small game in next week's conclusion of Upping Your Upland Game, Part 2. Check out fromfieldtoplate.com for all your recipes that you've heard and links back to each of these amazing chefs' personal sites. Until next week, get outdoors and remember, keep tasting wild.